Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, and heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, local and national fallout from the president's executive order affecting refugees, immigrants, travelers, and others. Also, Senator Orrin Hatch suspends rules in a committee he chairs to advance cabinet appointees. Representative Jason Chaffetz withdraws his bill to sell 3 million acres of public lands. And the latest from the Utah State Legislature. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham. Thanks for being here, Matt. Good morning.
Thank you.
Reporter Courtney Tanner covering the Federal Beat. Courtney, thank you very much for being here as well.
Thanks.
Editorial writer George Pyle, thanks to you and good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us via the phone from Washington Tribune, Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Greetings, Tommy, and welcome.
Hey, good morning.
Listeners, you can join the conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Well, this week there was a lot of uproar and confusion in response to the president's executive order on immigration and refugees, the executive order that I mentioned in the intro. Protests, as many refugees and immigrants were initially detained at airports. Hundreds showed up at the Salt Lake City International Airport to object to the order. And Courtney Tanner, you reported that scores of people slated to come to Utah as refugees were affected by this order. You spoke with representatives from the two groups doing refugee resettlement in Utah. And what did they tell you?
Yeah, so I talked to Catholic Community Services and the International Rescue Committee, and there's 64 people who were slated to come to Utah in February that no longer can because of this executive order.
These are people who were vetted through the process to be accepted as refugees, but because of the executive order are now, I guess they're stuck wherever it was that they were leaving from. Is that the idea?
Yeah, they're kind of in limbo. So they'd done all the necessary screening. They had apartments here ready to go, but now they're not coming anymore.
Well, after a suit by the ACLU, a federal judge put a stay on this order, and that paused, or at least was meant to pause, the deportation of valid visa holders. And there are some questions about how Customs and Border Protection officials were reading the judge's ruling. So many people were being held at airports, were let go. Others, I understand, weren't. Also, a number of reports of students attending American universities who were blocked from returning to the United States from visits outside of the U.S. That had officials at the University of Utah, Utah State, Salt Lake Community College, and other institutions giving advice to their international students and faculty. And Matt Canham, what was that advice?
So first off, what they said is that they wanted to welcome and make sure that these students and these faculty who come from overseas know that they are appreciated on campus. But then the advice was, don't go home, or you're probably not going to be able to come back in. And one thing that I didn't think about initially, but we learned about in a meeting at the University of Utah had, is that for a lot of these students who are international students, they're about to graduate, which is a big moment in anyone's life. And they wanted their family to come see them graduate from college.
Right.
Their family now can't visit the United States to see that. And that's kind of disappointing, I'm sure, for them. But they're stuck here. They either, you know, have to go through the 4 years of college until they can graduate and go home, or if they were going to try to stay here as legal permanent residents, they can't visit their families until this changes. Now, this is a temporary order, so we'll see how the administration affects that, you know, how they change it going forward after this thing kind of phases out.
Hmm. I want to remind our listeners that we invite you to join this conversation. What is your response to the president's executive order? How have you been affected? Are you pleased with this action? Upset? Call us at 801-355-8255. Again, that's 801-355-TALK. Religious organizations in Utah also issued statements on or related to this ruling. Matt, the Mormon Church's statement wasn't so much about this order as it was about refugees themselves, right?
Right. So the LDS Church doesn't tend to make statements on political issues. And so sometimes you have to read the tea leaves to figure out what's going on here. A lot of media organizations, including the Salt Lake Tribune, reached out to the LDS Church about this order because they previously, during the campaign, had issued another statement in response to a Donald Trump call for a ban on Muslims. Now, this is more nuanced than a flat ban on any Muslim entering the country. So what their statement was is they urged governments to be welcoming of people who are in harm's way, refugees, which you could kind of read as a sign that they're not 100% in favor of what's currently going on. Other religious organizations were much more direct. The Salt Lake City Catholic Diocese said they were dismayed and alarmed by this order. The Catholic Diocese and the Catholic Community Services, which is one of the two groups that Courtney talked about,
right.
The Catholics in this country are very involved in helping refugees resettle, and so they have been a little bit more outspoken.
Okay. Responses from religious groups there. Actually, I want to turn to Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent. And Thomas, I'm wondering what the response on this order has been from Utah's congressional delegation. Representative Mia Love expressed some concern, I understand, correct?
Yeah, they're kind of trying to walk a very fine line here because I think the Utah delegation knows that, Mormons were persecuted and driven from state to state when in the founding of the church. And so, they have some sensitivity to the fact that their constituents, are welcoming to refugees and understand the concept here. But they're also trying to talk about, the need for national security and, extreme vetting, as the president likes to call it. So in some ways, they're trying to, split between, we should look at this. It should be, we want some more details of how they're going to unravel this and make it work. But also trying to be like, we definitely need to, keep radical Islamic terrorists and such out of the country. So it will be interesting to see how this shakes out. I think there were a lot of people on the Hill who were a little surprised by this order. It sounds like from some of the reports, even Homeland Security and others were affected by this, were surprised by this order rolling out on a Friday, last Friday, actually, with kind of no heads up, it sounds like, with congressional leaders or the people who actually have to implement it.
Matt, I think that you may have written about this, but that Senator Mike Lee had comments about this as well, expressing, again, that idea that there's some questions about how this was rolled out or questions about some of the details, not so much a condemnation of the order itself, though. In fact, I don't know if anybody actually condemned the order from the Utah delegation.
I think Mia Love got closest.
Okay.
She's the daughter of immigrants, and she spoke a little bit about her concerns. Mike Lee, during the campaign, was repeatedly critical of Donald Trump, in part because of his comments about Muslims. And I think that that's one of the reasons that we reached out is that to Mike Lee when this first happened, is because Mike Lee not only was critical of Donald Trump about it, but also used that as one of the reasons he did not vote for the Republican nominee during the presidential race. So we wanted to hear what he had to say. And essentially, he punted. He said that he had technical questions about this order, and he wanted to get more answers, which is a sign that he had no idea that it was coming. But it also is not a glowing support for what Donald Trump's trying to do either.
You know, we have a comment here.
I have some technical questions from about Matt's comment there. No, I'm joking.
Technical questions from Tommy Burr. We've got a caller on the line here. This is Nick from Salt Lake City who has a comment about Rick from Salt Lake City, who has a question about, or not, excuse me, a comment about this immigration policy. Tell us your comment, Rick.
Hi. Well, I was just saying to your screener that I am appalled by the actions. I think they've been cavalier. I think they've been callous. I study at the university. I take classes. I'm a retired person. And I think that having people from other countries enriches the environment at the U. And I just feel terrible for the people who have been personally and really horribly affected by this action.
All right. Comment from Rick there in Salt Lake City. And this is the kind of point that I think Donald Trump, the president makes, George Pyle, is that he's trying to do something about safety, he says, for I think, the title of the order itself is Protecting America. I can't remember the exact language, but a lot of people are seeing something else. They're seeing the Muslim ban that he promised on the campaign trail.
Yeah, to some degree, it's like this shouldn't be a surprise because he said during the campaign he was going to put a total ban on all Muslims. I think the phrase was something like, until we figure out what the hell is going on. Well, and that's part of the reason for doing this, he said, is because we haven't They didn't put this in the document, but we haven't figured out what the hell is going on. We need to do more vetting, despite the fact that a lot of these people have been vetted for 2 years. They've gone through all kinds of process. They've been, some of them are coming for war-torn places where you can't just walk down to the county clerk's office and get somebody's birth certificate because it's been blown up. But so it's not like you would vet somebody from Sweden or Canada, but they have been through a process. They've been checked out. They've been confirmed to be fleeing a war zone or fleeing religious persecution in some way. And it was very easy for people to look at this and say, well, look, he's claiming it's not a Muslim ban because it's only a few countries. There are a lot of Muslim countries that aren't included. Like the largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia. Nobody's even talking about them. But then other people have gone through and said, well, look here. Here are the countries that have from where people have been banned. Here are the countries from which people have come to America and killed us. They're different countries. Like Saudi Arabia isn't on the list. Here is a list of countries where Donald Trump does business. It matches up remarkably well with the list of Muslim countries that aren't banned.
I want, actually, just on the point, the vetting question, refugee resettlement groups who work with the United States government say that the vetting of refugees involves 6 different security databases, 5 background checks, 8 U.S. agencies, including the Department of Homeland Security, State Department, the FBI's Terrorist Screening Center, the Department of Defense. There are 4 biometric security checks. It takes 2 years, as George Pyle pointed out there, for all of this to happen. And I know that, for example, and Tommy Burr, if you're still there on the line, that Chris Stewart in Washington wants to see additional vetting. Do we know how much more or what else he wants to see happen?
No, but maybe we can make a reality show out of it. It seems to be the current president's love.
You're fired.
It's not clear. And everyone's
you're in.
Being,
yeah.
Everyone's, exactly. Everyone's being incredibly vague about what more they're going to do. The White House doesn't seem to know what more they're going to do. It's just, you know, Trump is fulfilling a promise he made in the campaign for this extreme vetting without noting what the heck extreme is. I will note real fast that I think this has been the fun week of, is it a ban when they're calling it a ban? The president's called it a ban. The White House press secretary says, oh, that's the media calling it a ban, when Donald Trump's tweeting about it being a ban. So who knows if it's a ban or not, but clearly people are being barred from the country. How about that?
I'm wondering, sure, Matt Canham.
I was just going to say, one idea that has been talked about in Washington is they do these interviews. You talked about all the databases they go through, but as we also pointed out, some of these countries like Syria have been really decimated in some areas. So actually getting documents and verifying a story is difficult. So one thing that they've at least bandied about as an idea for increased vetting is an ideological test, and asking of what you think about a free and open society, what you think about the rights women should have, these kind of things, where the idea would be to try to identify whether an incoming refugee could be radicalized in the future. That's a very difficult process and would have a lot of questions. So one thing that I think that we in the media are going to keep an eye on in these next 120 days is what additional screening processes go in it, what questions these refugees are asked, and what we're really trying to get at. It's going to be something we're going to have to keep an eye on.
A reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation, 801-355-8255 is the number to call, 801-355-TALK. I'm not certain who might be able to address this, but the Trump administration has been here and there saying that the measures that they took on immigration and refugees is somehow akin to something that President Obama did in 2011. A lot of people are pointing out that this is actually quite a bit different. Tommy Burr, can you address that?
Yeah, sure. In fact, President Obama made clear that in one of his first comments as an ex-president that this was not similar to what he had done in office. And there was a little bit of a hold he put on some people, like, I believe, coming from Iraq at the time, but nowhere near this kind of more broad ban of people from 7 countries, Muslim-dominated countries, including, you know, green card holders and visa holders. In no way near is this to what President Obama did. But, you know, that's the spin coming out of the White House because they maybe they didn't expect the vitriol that came out of this, but they probably should have.
Matt or Tommy, we talked about the response from Washington. What has Governor Gary Herbert said on this issue, Matt?
Yeah, Governor Gary Herbert, who has been critical of the idea that we should take less refugees, even during President Obama's time. During that time, President Obama increased the number of refugees we were going to take, and a lot of Republican governors said they didn't want them because they were worried about these security issues that President Trump's talking about. Gary Herbert was the one Republican governor who welcomed them. And last night, or about yesterday in the afternoon, we had a family from Afghanistan arrive in the United States, or excuse me, arrive here at the airport. And it was the last refugees that are going to come until this ban fades out. And they were greeted by 300, at least 300 Utahns who were cheering for them. There was kind of a surprise. And Governor Herbert tweeted that out and called them Utah's newest pioneers.
Wow.
Which is a strong sign of support.
Remarkable
and we have video of it too
at the Salt Lake Tribune's
which
website,
which is really neat because the father of this family is touched, has a big smile on his face, and the kids all look stunned and tired. Can you imagine flying from Pakistan to Utah and then get off the plane and 300 people with balloons and flowers are cheering for you? That'd be an interesting day.
And that's, you know, coming from the editorial page where we said this ban, whatever you call it, was a really rotten idea. We quoted Ronald Reagan as saying, you know, his shining city on the hill, and if it has to have walls, the walls have doors. And anybody with the gumption to get here is welcome. And Gary Herbert said similar things. And it just strikes us on the editorial page, and you hear it from the religious leaders. You hear it from business leaders. I mean, who's really ticked off by this? Google, Apple, Ford. They do business all over the world. They need to be able to have their employees come and go without worrying about whether the guy at immigration is going to check their cell phone for the wrong kind of app or search their social media feed for something that they might think is suspect. Mm-hmm. And then at the same time, as we saw the family coming, I mean, most of the people who are coming under these circumstances are children. And they're not terrorists. And if you're worried about people being radicalized, I mean, the best way to radicalize 1.6 billion people is to not let them leave war zones.
Well, and people fleeing violence, terror, war. The other part of this is that while the order does have in the title the words protecting the nation, there are more than a few experts, including at least 1,000 State Department employees who have signed a so-called dissent memo, who say that this will probably have the opposite effect.
No, this is. I mean, if you asked ISIS, what do you want Donald Trump to do? This would probably be number one on their list.
I want to turn. There's a comment that we have from Danny in Logan, who says that people should call their congressman and let them know how they feel. He also doesn't think Trump could pass his own test to get into the country. I want to get to the topic of calls to congressional offices in a little bit, but first we need to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will turn to that and to news out of the Utah State Legislative Session, as well as some additional news from Washington. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Thomas Burr, Courtney Tanner, and George Pyle. You can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Thomas Burr, there in Washington, you wrote, before we left, we were talking about Utah response to the executive order on refugees and immigrants. You wrote about an opinion poll that the Tribune conducted just ahead of Trump's signing this executive order. This was actually last week. That showed that most Utahns were opposed to suspending or severely curtailing the acceptance of refugees. Is that it in a nutshell?
Yeah, exactly. And I think, again, it goes back to what I was saying before about, you know, Utah is predominantly Mormon, and Mormons know their history, that, you know, some of their ancestors were moved from state to state. In Missouri one time, it was legal to kill a Mormon because they wanted them exterminated. And we go back to the history of the founding of the church. I mean, if we all want to go back really far, the founding of the Republican Party was in part their first platform was against Mormons because they were worried about the polygamy thing. Most Utahns, majority of Utahns, are concerned about curtailing or suspending that. There's a good chunk that are for it. However, Congressman Chris Stewart, who sits in the House Intel Committee, was saying, you didn't ask the question right, because, of course, philosophically, it sounds great to let, we should let all refugees in. But he's saying, if you can't have a refugee from Syria who has no documents and ISIS has been forging documents, how do you know if that's really somebody you want to let in the country? Philosophically, Utahns are kind of like Governor Herbert and say, welcome.
And Senator Orrin Hatch also issued a statement that expressed that sort of philosophical sentiment, not so much concern about the order, but support for refugees who are fleeing violence and terror as well. And also, there is a march planned this weekend. I'm sure it's something the Tribune will be covering.
Tanner will be covering.
She's here in the studio with us.
Did she just get assigned that, or did she know already?
She did know already.
At this exact moment, she's been assigned to it. Well, guys, let's leave the topic of this executive order behind for a little bit and turn to the state legislative session. And Matt Canham, we are now about, a fourth of the way through this year's meeting of lawmakers.
Is that it?
That's it, exactly. You thought it was further. And there's a lot that the Tribune is covering on the Hill. Maybe to begin with, we could talk about what's happening with two resolutions related to national monuments in Utah. There are a couple of resolutions that are making their way through the legislature. We talked a little bit about this last week, but they are progressing. Tell us about these resolutions.
So these are two resolutions, one to encourage Donald Trump to get rid of bear's ears and one to encourage Donald Trump to shrink the Grand Staircase National Monument. And the House rammed these through without hearings, which caused a lot of uproar from those who support these national monuments. They now made it to the House. The Senate. So last night there were Senate committee hearings on this. There were two back to back. Very raucous crowds of supporters, mostly, for these monuments, and the lawmakers, the senators, critical of them. So it was a big give and take. They passed easily. They're going to pass the Senate easily. The question isn't really what happens here. It's what happens in Washington. Does President Donald Trump look at this and other information he gets from, say, Senator Orrin Hatch or other people he talks to from Utah and say, yeah, I'm going to give this a go. I'm going to try to either rescind this national monument altogether or shrink its size, something that has no president has ever wiped out a national monument, though presidents have tried to trim them a bit.
Have we heard, whether or not the Trump administration, his interior secretary pick for, I don't know how much of an effect Ryan Zinke would have, he's not yet confirmed, but have they indicated a receptiveness to this request?
So Ryan Zinke has promised to come to Utah soon after he is confirmed to visit this area, which shows that they're at least open to the conversation. The Trump family, Donald Trump Jr., Donald Trump himself, have not express much interest in the idea of taking federal land and selling it back to states or to private entities. But they have talked a lot about wanting to get rid of things that President Obama did. And so this obviously fits in that category. So I think this is one where it's not 100% sure if this is going to make it to the top of Donald Trump's list, but it easily could have.
Tribal leaders who advocated for this monument, I would imagine, are unhappy with state lawmakers, those who did.
Yeah. So that was the big outpouring yesterday, is these people who didn't feel like they had a chance to try to stop this resolution in the House had a chance in the Senate, but it was limited in very specific ways because the debate was going on long and there was actually some time-limited access to this room. Each person who wanted to defend these national monuments had a total of 75 seconds to make their case. And at one point, one of the people speaking was critical of what the House Speaker said and talked about how seeing starry skies is a good idea. And if you, want to, see the comparison, go outside of the Capitol and see what you can see. I'm talking about the inversion here in Utah, which got a huge amount of applause from the supportive crowd. And at that point, the chairwoman of the committee just shut it down. and moved it on. There's definitely some contention there, which isn't surprising because there's been contention on these public lands issues for decades and decades and decades here in Utah.
You know, I want to come back to the topic of public lands, but first I would like to turn to Tommy Burr, who, Tommy, I know we only have you for a little bit longer, and I want to get a couple of stories that you covered in before we let you go. And one of the things that you wrote about, I'm just thinking about this sometimes partisan divide over public lands, but there are other partisan divides in Washington right now. And Senator Orrin Hatch complaining about Democrats boycotting a committee hearing to vote on two appointees, not Ryan Zinke, but a couple of other cabinet appointees. Tell us about this. He called Democrats idiots, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
He said they should stop acting like idiots,
okay. So
just to be clear. So, but he also had some other choice words to talk about Democrats. So there were two of Trump's nominees up for the Senate Finance Committee to be confirmed. Republicans are in the majority. It's clear they were going to get confirmed. But the Democrats decided to boycott. And so we have Tom Price, who's up to head the Health and Human Services Department, Steve Mnuchin up for being Treasury Secretary. And the Democrats were no-shows at the confirmation vote in committee. And Senate rules require them to go through a committee process. So they went, you know, the Republicans show up. There's no one on the other side of the dais. And Hatch is a little upset about that. They come back the next day. Same thing. Democrats boycotted. Again. And so because there were no Democrats, Hatch and his Republicans just moved to change the rule that they could do it without a Democrat present. And because there wasn't a Democrat present, they couldn't object to the Republicans changing the rule. So both Price and Mnuchin were pushed forward with just the 14-0 vote because there weren't any Democrats in the room.
You know, a lot of people have pointed out that Republicans, Senator Hatch included, you know, wouldn't hold a hearing on Merrick Garland, the President Obama's pick for Supreme Court, for a number of months. Maybe it was 9 months on this, and that this is sort of, I don't know, the pot calling the kettle black or whatever it is.
There is a difference between a cabinet secretary and a Supreme Court justice, so let's just be clear on that part.
Right.
But, yeah, there's certainly a lot of vitriol. And you know what this really does set up, since we're talking about the Supreme Court, if Republicans are willing to change the rules because they're upset with how the Democrats are reacting, let's look at this showdown that's going to happen with the new nominee for the Supreme Court, Gorsuch, and say, Gorsuch, I guess,
yeah.
What's going to happen there? Will they get rid of the nuclear, or will they go nuclear and get rid of the filibuster and just be able to pass and approve this new Supreme Court nominee with 51 votes instead of having to go to the 60 they need to get past the threshold on the filibuster?
Hmm. I want to bring George Pyle in on this. And Tommy Burr, I know that we got to let you go. Thomas Burr, Washington correspondent with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us for the first half of this program, and best of luck on your reporting.
Great. Thanks, Roger.
Okay. George Pyle, going back to just the idea that Senator Hatch is changing rules to allow committee members to be, it's not committee members, but cabinet appointees to be,
right,
to have a vote and be passed, advanced to their next vote at the Senate floor. Again, is there a sort of, I don't know, irony at least in the fact that that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things, I think, that builds so much cynicism among members of the public for all politicians, because this is a case where when the Democrats are in control of the Senate, they frustrate, they blockade, they filibuster, or they don't let the minority Republicans filibuster. They change the rules so that they can win. And then all Republicans say, oh, horrible, you're demeaning the world's greatest deliberative body. We're supposed to all be equal and open here, and the minority is supposed to have a voice. And then the Republicans get in and they do the very same thing the Democrats were doing to try and squelch the voices of the minority, because they can. They change the rules. They decide that you can filibuster a cabinet member but not a Supreme Court justice, or you can do various things. And it just completely changed the thing. And I mean, I've been talking to people who are much more politically conservative than I am, who share my feeling that Democrats and Republicans are just like teams. And the ideology of it is almost beside the point. You want to be in control so you can hire your friends, so you can hand out the perks of government, so you can get the bigger office in the nicer committee room. And then when you're out, you know, you all populate the think tanks and the law firms and things like that. And then when you're back in, you all rush back in. And it has so much, it has very little to do with what you think the government ought to do and what policy ought to be, and just to do with scoring points on each other.
Partisan politics may be polarizing. I wanted to actually turn from the just specific cabinet appointees to back to the Supreme Court and the fact that we do now have a nominee who's been put forward by Trump, Neil Gorsuch, a Westerner from Colorado. And Courtney Tanner, I don't know if you can address this, but I'm assuming that Utah's delegation in Washington is behind this choice for Supreme Court.
Orrin Hatch, for instance, called him an inspired choice. And I mean, his ideology, Neil Gorsuch's ideology, really aligns well with Utah representatives. I mean, he's for religious freedoms. He wrote the dissent on the Planned Parenthood case, which means he came out in favor of Governor Herbert. And so he really aligns with their policies.
And some have even sort of tried to say that he's cut from the same cloth as Antonin Scalia, who passed away last year and whose seat is empty. Is there any kind of tactic that the Democrats can employ to try and prevent this confirmation from occurring? Does anybody have a thought on that?
Tactic to stop it? Yeah. I mean, this is the debate within the Democrats in Congress, is whether to pull out all the stops to stop this one or wait until there's a potential next one, because this one does not change the balance that we've had on the court historically. It has been 5-4 leaning conservative. So there's a debate on whether pull out all the stops, filibuster, throw everything at this, or hold fire to the next one. And that's not uncommon, because when you have a change in power from one party to the other, strategy, there's no leader who's leading the strategy. They're all trying to figure out who's in charge. The Democrats are not a cohesive group at the moment. And I think right now they're not sure where to go. What it does appear, like Merrick Garland, Gorsuch appears to be quite qualified for the position. There's nothing that's an immediate outlier from any norm we've seen in past Supreme Court nominees.
Courtney Tanner, Senator Orrin Hatch, I believe, met with Gorsuch and gave a kind of glowing endorsement. Is that right?
Yeah, he, I guess, gave advice on how Gorsuch could kind of navigate this nomination process.
Do we know what that advice was?
I'm going to guess that it's not answer any questions. If you've seen Supreme Court nomination hearings in recent years, they're really inflammatory questions at which the nominee politely declines to answer.
Yeah, they have this more or less real, truthful, judicial idea that, well, I really shouldn't answer that because some case might come before me and I don't want to prejudice my thoughts on this. And, you know, there's a law school reason for saying that. But it's both parties' nominees, both parties, and then the opposite party does the same thing. They try and trap them. They try and get them to say something really inflammatory or something that makes them sound like they're really weird and give some reason why they shouldn't be approved. And they're all smart enough not to fall into that trap.
I'd like to remind our listeners that you can call us with your thoughts on the stories that we are covering from this past week. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. You can also comment at sltrib.com. As long as we're talking about fights between Democrats and Republicans in Washington, in this case, there have been some mini battles here in Utah, as there always are at this year's meeting of lawmakers. And Matt Canham, one source of that conflict is a measure to do away with a sort of fairness requirement on some boards and commissions. This effectively lets the governor or the legislature avoid having to put Democrats or maybe I should say non-Republicans on these boards and commissions.
Right. So this is a bill that's moving through the legislature now. The House has passed it. It's on to the Senate. And the sponsor, his name's Norm Thurston. He's from Provo. His idea is that what he's arguing is that the governor has a hard time filling positions on boards that oversee energy or water or alcohol policy or any other number of issues because he can't find qualified Democrats to fit on these boards in a state that's so conservative. Democrats find that to be ridiculous and say, boards are hard to fill because they don't pay anything and they're really controversial and difficult and people don't want to serve on boards. So this is the debate. And The way it works now is there is a partisan expectation that you would have at least a Democrat on some of these boards. Mm-hmm. That does not mean that they would be equal numbers in a state that's this conservative. Obviously, the Republicans would have more spots, as they do on just about every board we have. So this bill passed, but they did soften it because there were some Republicans who felt a little sympathy for the idea that there should be opposing viewpoints. And so a couple of the higher profile ones, such as the alcohol mm-hmm. board, air quality board, water quality board, the Commission on Service and Volunteerism, they decided that Democrats can keep those spots. But on some other ones, they're still going to try to strip it.
So they narrowed the list of boards and commissions that would be affected by this bill,
right.
essentially. This reminds me of something. It's very similar to something that happened last year at the legislature, sort of, the requirement that the bipartisan membership in
audits
right,
management.
Right. These are two legislative committees. What happened there?
So that one was there were two committees that oversee parts of the legislature that had equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. And the Republicans looked around and said, there's really like a handful of Democrats and the rest of us are Republicans. Why do they have equal say? So they changed the rules in that category. Now, this one obviously doesn't fit exactly that area, but it highlights how small the Democratic minority is in this state. Mm-hmm. And Republicans feel that they should have ultimate control on these issues because voters put them into office.
That bill last year did pass into law, but it passed into law without Governor Gary Herbert's signature, a sort of protest.
There is a debate within the Republican Party itself over whether it's healthy to have a stronger minority party. I've talked to Republicans in Utah who wish Democrats won more seats because it's healthy to have someone poke holes in your argument. It allows you to make better policy. So there is a debate, and I think you kind of see that at sometimes high levels of our government, of whether this makes sense to have everyone from one group on a board.
Okay, having a counter argument. We will maybe stay with that story a little bit when we come back from a break, but at the moment we do have to turn to another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and Utah Public Radio around the state. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Courtney Tanner, George Pyle, and before Thomas Burr, but he has left us now. Join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. We were, before earlier in the show, talking about the topic of public lands and the Bears Ears National Monument, two resolutions at the Utah State Legislature, but Courtney Tanner, another story having to do with public lands. Representative Jason Chaffetz recently resurrected a proposal he has floated in past years to, quote unquote, dispose of or sell off certain federal public lands, somewhere around 3 million acres worth. We learned this week that he had a change of heart. What happened there?
Representative Chaffetz decided to abandon the bill. He'd kind of gotten some feedback from some conservation groups and some sportsmen groups, and so he withdrew the bill yesterday.
Okay, withdrew the bill. And this was in response to particular pressure from groups. You mentioned sportsmen's groups in the photo that he posted on Instagram when he announced that he was going to take this bill down. He was wearing camouflage. He was on a trail somewhere. Was this specifically about hunters coming forward and saying, we don't like this bill?
Well, I mean, it was kind of a confluence of the sportsmen and conservation groups. But Chaffetz's post says, I'm a proud gun owner. I'm a hunter. I love our land. So he does kind of side with that.
George Pyle, I want to drag you into this conversation. Is this about the power of the people putting pressure on elected officials? Is that why Chaffetz changed his mind here?
Well, obviously. I mean, people are saying, all the comments and tweets are like, hey, public pressure works. This is also a case, though, I think, where you've got the people who wear Birkenstocks and the people who wear hip boots are together on this. They don't want public lands turned over. That's why, like in Montana, when we're having big demonstrations to say take back public lands, in Montana, they're having big demonstrations to say over my dead body, you'll take back the public lands. They tried it a little bit in Montana. It worked out very badly. And the big impact that people saw was that you couldn't go hunting because certain parts of land were now off limits and people put fences where there weren't fences before. And so they're taking a look at this and they're saying, no, we're public land states. We like public lands. We like being able to wander around and shoot big animals. And that's why there's some hope that the new president and the new Secretary of the Interior won't just roll back these monuments because they like to go hunting.
Everything you've said is great, but I can't now help but think of a hybrid between Birkenstocks and hip boots. Yes. That's the only thing I can contemplate. Well, you know, on the topic of public lands, putting pressure on public officials, Courtney Tanner, you wrote about frustrations that Utahns were facing trying to reach out to their public officials to have their voices heard, not on public lands necessarily, but maybe on cabinet appointees or on the Trump administration itself. Or on this executive order on immigration and refugees, people are having a hard time connecting with their politicians. Why is that the case?
A lot of these politicians, Senator Orrin Hatch specifically, have full voicemail boxes. So right, you've got residents calling in, hundreds of residents calling in, and they get this message that says, well, this voicemail's full, try again later, and then it just hangs up on them.
Okay, so Senator Orrin Hatch, for one, blamed robocalls from other states for this problem. Is there any way for us to know whether or not that's actually what's causing this? Could it be constituents, local constituents, flooding the phone lines, or how do we know?
Most of the representatives have said, you know, we've got a flood of out-of-state callers, so a lot of East Coasters are calling, New Yorkers, people from Pennsylvania, just kind of filling in those lines. That's what's happening with Jason Chaffetz's office, for instance.
Is there, Matt Canham, I'm going to suggest a Salt Lake Tribune poll for you. I want to know how many people have tried to call their elected officials in the last week or month, because it seems like there's a renewed energy when it comes to trying to get engaged with your politicians in the wake of the election of Donald Trump.
We've seen massive protests across the country and even in parts internationally as well. And I think part of the outpouring of opposition from liberal groups has also been the idea that you should just press your members of Congress on all kinds of issues, whether that's a cabinet appointee you don't like, this immigration ban that Trump put out there, or any other issue that he said. And I think what we've seen throughout Congress, and not just here in Utah, this is not just unique to Utah's members. They're getting flooded and flooded with calls and letters.
Yeah, and there was I couldn't find it, but there was a posting somewhere from a former congressional staffer who said, look, if you want to be heard, call. Don't write. Don't email. Don't even march in the streets. Get on the phone and call your representatives. That they hear. Their staff tallies these up, if they ever listen to the voicemail. And even if you don't actually get to speak to Senator Hatch, somebody in his office will talk to you or hear the message. And even if they don't pass along the details, there's a tally. You know, 500 people called on this side, 200 people called on this side. They listen to that.
Courtney Tanner, does that bear with what you've heard from people in these offices?
That's what most of them have said, and also residents kind of feel that that's the way to get through. We have one woman in Utah who actually got so frustrated that she couldn't get a call in that she sent Senator Orrin Hatch a pizza with a little message pinned to it to say, like, this is how I feel. His office rejected the pizza, so the message didn't actually get through. But, you know, people are getting frustrated, and so they're trying to think of some creative solutions to get around that.
And they'd probably have to report that as a bribe.
Okay, so don't send a bribe along with your suggestion. But yeah. Senator Hatch also made a comment that, or his office, I guess, said that if phone lines are busy, try and reach out via other methods.
Yeah, social media. You can handwrite a letter, I guess. You can email him. There are different ways, but phone calls are generally the preferred.
And you would imagine that a constituent, somebody calling from within your district, that voice matters a great deal more than that of, say, a caller from the East Coast or someone with a different agenda.
Yeah, there was actually I hope this is right. I think it was a staffer for Jason Chaffetz who last year wrote a blog post about how to get in touch with their member of Congress. And what she said was, that phone calls were most effective, but also if you're going to write, it has to be unique. It can't just be a form letter. And that's the kind of messages that these people, these politicians take seriously. And obviously the Jason Chaffetz example this week is one of those where he heard from people and he decided to change what he was doing.
Okay. Guys, we have hit the end of the hour and we need to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week, stories that maybe didn't get as much coverage as others did or that are just interesting to each of you? Who's ready with an underplayed story? Courtney Tanner?
Lee Davidson did this really interesting profile on House Majority Leader Brad Wilson, and it kind of goes into how he fell into politics and how he fell into this position. And, I mean, Brad Wilson's a really powerful person in Utah, so it's an interesting read.
Profile of Brad Wilson at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, have you got one prepared?
I'm going to go with the Lee Davidson story. I'm going to keep up the trend here. This was yesterday. There was a bill in the legislature involving the Utah Transit Authority. A Democratic House Representative, Karen Main, said that UTA is arrogant and secretive, and she's pushing a legislation that would require them to have their meetings to be open, block them from hiring union-busting consultants. And in the Republican legislature, it got unanimous support in committee. This is how frustrated local politicians are with the transit agency and its troubles over the years.
Okay, so some transparency or a move for transparency at Utah Transit Authority. George Pyle, have you got an underplayed story of the week?
Well, this is, I wouldn't call this underplay, but it's new. We just had it this morning, a story about Salt Lake City has now come out with a new plan to try and address one of the big underlying problems of homelessness, which is there isn't enough affordable housing. And you have this domino effect of, you know, people who might be able to afford an apartment if there were affordable apartments. And so now they have this big plan that would try and lean on developers to include affordable units in their developments, try and spread them around the city so that every neighborhood has to do their part. It's kind of a big, complex deal, and there's going to be a lot of fighting over it. But somebody has to do something, and this is a way to move forward.
All right, George Pyle with his pick there. I'm going to go with just a shout-out to Robert Gerke, columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune, has a column on Groundhog's Day, air quality, the Utah State Legislature. You can check it out at sltrib.com. Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham, reporter Courtney Tanner, and editorial writer George Pyle, also Tommy Burr, who was on the phone with us earlier. Thanks very much for joining us today, you guys.
Thank you.
We will wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Today, Kirby talks about excommunication. Back in November, you wrote questioning, I guess maybe rhetorically, or this is the headline, why haven't I been excommunicated yet? And
that is a question that I get asked on a regular basis on Facebook or email. Why haven't I been excommunicated? And then the follow-up question, well, is then why haven't you left Mormonism? And I've been asked that question so many times that I've gotten tired of repeating myself about it. And the truth of the matter is that the LDS Church or most other organizations aren't going to excommunicate you unless they see you as a genuine threat, meaning that you're encouraging other people to leave, you're exhorting people to depart from the faith or whatever. And I'm not in any way doing that any more than I would tell Catholics, you know, you got to stop being Catholics. It just doesn't work. And so what I write about essentially is my Mormon family. And we are strange. Every family is strange. This is just the Mormon version of it.
You talk about, you know, there was a bishop in a ward who kind of got spooked by the fact that you were spiritually uncooperative, as you put it. And he didn't admonish you, and you weren't asked to change, but he didn't talk to you for a while, apparently.
He didn't really know what to do with someone like me. And I'm okay with that. I mean, you have to be willing to, if you're going to be this way, you have to be willing to take the lumps that come with it. And I'm fine. Will I ever be a bishop? No. But I don't want to be either.
Do you get more sort of blowback from things you write in the Tribune that may be, oh, I don't know, challenging to members of the LDS Church? Do you get more blowback from people in social circles than you do from sort of church hierarchy or from?
Yeah, I actually know members of the church hierarchy. We occasionally talk, and there's never any notion that what I'm doing is bad or wrong. I'm sure that they would rather I didn't say some things, but they know where I live. They can call me. I'll keep it a secret.
you know, I think about reformist elements of any church through history. I mean, is it kind of, do you have a sense of trying to reform anything and doing more work from the inside than from the outside? I mean, that's, I'm sure that's the question you get all the time, and I'm parroting that.
And the truth of the matter is that if I have any altruistic sense about this at all, it is that there is room in the LDS Church for people who don't agree with everything. That you don't have to be like every other person in sacrament meeting in order to participate. You know, I go to church. I hear things all the time that I don't agree with. But, hell, I hear that at my family reunions, too. I'm not going to quit going to those.
Right. Sort of, to steal a term, kind of a big tent.
Yes, it is. And you just got to get over yourself. You really do when it comes down to that, because there's so much positive. There are things my wife does that drive me out of my mind, but I am not in any way going to ever divorce her, because the pros outweigh the cons.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby to end this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find all of his opinions, the full Kirby archives, at sltrib.com. That does it for the show today. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. Thanks to you as well for tuning in. You can find podcasts of this show at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever you use to get podcasts on your smartphone or device. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for tuning in. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again next Friday.